for the invitation. And welcome to my talk, which I've entitled A Model of Austrian Economics. Now, Austrian scholars have traditionally been very reluctant in using models, and this is also, I think, for good reasons, because I'm not sure whether modeling is actually always like adding to our insights. Yeah, may help us to formulate certain ideas, but when we look at what's happening in the neoclassical scene or in the new Keynesian scene, I don't know whether modeling as such is something which adds value to science. I'm not sure. On the other hand, we have to admit that we are not really dominating the academic debate as Austrians. And one of the reasons for this actually may be, in my opinion, is that we do not have models. When I talk to people, then sometimes I get this, like, okay, sounds interesting, your Austrian craziness, but can you show it to me? Like, what is it? Yeah, and then I say, all right, here's a copy of Human Action, and then they say, oh, thank you, I'll read that later. Yeah, and they never do. So models are, in a way, are a way to condense thoughts and to make them accessible to people which are a tool to like to convey ideas in a very narrow way, and I think this helps a lot for teaching. I think if you want to tell somebody what is Austrian economics, then using a model, using certain formalization, using certain illustrations may help. And in the next 45 minutes, I will try to convince you that the model that I have built is actually a way that economics could be taught, and also maybe that it should be taught this way, because this model is, in my opinion, more realistic and also easier to understand than a DSGE model or anything else. Moreover, what this model also does is that it offers a connection to the system of national accounts. For reasons which are certainly beyond the scope of this talk, the economic debate and the political debate is largely centered on GDP. Yeah? How much growth do we get next year? And for Austrians, it's not always obvious to make these connections, to draw these connections. I think we have a shortcoming here, because when we talk to neoclassicals, they can always say, well, this is a GDP figure, such and such. We cannot do that because we don't have, the connection is not so obvious. Now, this model offers these connections, and I think this is also an element of it. Now, let's just take a first look at the model. On this slide, I've put a few elements which I think describe it. And I think the model is best described as agent-based and accounting-based. That is, there is no equilibrium. Yeah? All action happens through the agents. Yeah? The agents act on markets. They exchange goods against money, and these actions make certain patterns emerge. Yeah, that is, we are completely always in disequilibrium, and we have markets, and they are real markets, so to say. Goods are exchanged against money, okay? And in addition, every agent has a balance sheet. Balance sheet measures his liquidity position and all his assets and liabilities, and it's like a normal accounting standard every agent applies to himself. Now, then the agents have certain goals, and they have certain algorithms or decision rules which like give them hints of how they could possibly achieve their goals. They do this under uncertainty. They cannot know the future. They don't even have probability distributions about the future. They only look at themselves. They look at their own balance sheet. They look at what could I do with my situation now? And then they act accordingly. That is, they're not maximizing anything. They have a procedure or rationality. And yes, it is a rationality, but it is not a rationality in a neoclassical sense in that they would maximize a certain function. It's only implicit. Maximization is happening behind the scenes, so to say. And how do we all do this? Well, the model is run by in a Java environment. Yeah, so it's an object-oriented program which implements these actions and then tracks the economic and the macroeconomic patterns which emerge from these actions. In that sense, it's an evolutionary model. Okay. This is a nutshell. And what I'll do now is I walk you through this model, and I'll draw certain spotlights on different elements, and then I hope that in the end there will be something like a coherent picture that you will get. So I start with the set of the model, and then continue with the behavioral aspects, and then show what this all does. Okay. Now, so and. Yeah, as I said, we do have markets, and these markets are governed by the agents themselves. Yeah. Every agent, when he wants to sell a product, he makes an offer on a given market. And this such an offer always specifies the quantity that is on sale and the price that he wants for a unit of that good. Hence, every offer is a horizontal element of a supply curve, yeah, which we see on the left panel here. And we have a number of agents, and all of them have a little supply curve, which are the horizontal elements. And then all together, this is like a supply curve, yeah, which describes the total supply that is in a market. And it also describes the price spectrum at which this quantity is available. That is, we have the law of one price does not hold in this model. We have always price dispersion. Yeah? And this price dispersion is actually very important, because only if there's price dispersion, then the market and the pricing can have actually a signaling function. Yeah? And it can convey information. So this is the left panel. This is how a market looks in general. And then this is only the supply. Yeah? Supply constitutes the market, and then the demanders or the customers go to the market and they consult a certain number of offers. They cannot consult all the offers which are there, because it takes too much time and search is costly. So what they do is they go to the market and they look for three offers which are chosen randomly, and then this is what the right panel shows. They find three offers in the market, they all offer a certain quantity and a certain price. And then they choose the one with the lowest price because they want to save money. And put this into perspective with their own reservation price, which I'll explain later. But transactions then occur whenever they find a price which is below their reservation price. Yeah? And then what happens? Now in this case, he will choose this offer which is here the lowest one, that's actually within his reservation demand, and then he will make a purchase. And then what happens is that the market is updated. Yeah? So the supplier then sells the good, he gets the money, and one instance later, he will shorten his supply curve, and a new state of the market comes into being. Okay? So, and this is the way how the entire model evolves into the future. Yeah? And then the next customer comes to the market. He looks for three offers, and then picks the one with the lowest price, and maybe buys the good if it's rational to do so, and then again the market will be updated, and so on and so on. This is true for all markets which are existing in this model. Now, the financial structure of the economy is as depicted in those three balance sheets here. We have, first of all, a quantity of money, and all this money is held by the banks. The banks do so on account of the owners of the money. That is, we have MH and MF, which are sight deposits, yeah, and they are deposits of the households and the firms, and they use this money to make transactions. So whenever a household buys something, then he tells his bank, could you please transfer the money from my account to a different account? Yeah? And the firms do the same thing when they buy goods. Yeah? And so everything works on the basis of checking accounts, yeah? And they are like managed by the banks. In addition, the banks take also time deposits, yeah, which I've labeled S for savings, and they can use these time deposits to make loans to firms. So we have a market for loanable funds, and the firms then in turn use these loanable funds to invest. They buy capital goods, they buy fixed capital goods, they hire labor, and whenever they buy something, it is first activated in their balance sheet, and when they sell it, then it is deactivated and it enters their profit and loss statement, and they make a profit or a loss. And finally, the households basically own the entire economy. Yeah, they own the equity of the banks and the firms, and hence the entire net worth like the households. Now, this is how the transactions can be depicted. This is like a transaction matrix, which shows how these transactions actually work. Before you look at the colorful part, I ask you to look at the current accounts of each sector, which are in the first column. And you should realize that this is a full-fledged accounting system. Yeah, we have consumption expenditure, which runs from the households to the firms. We have wages, which go in the other direction. We have, interest payments, dividend payments, all that. And so you can actually already calculate GDP and all its subcomponents from this little economy. Yeah. So we have actually a full-fledged accounting system right here. Yeah, it's no big deal, it just emerges. In addition, the colorful part in the middle shows how actually profits are calculated in this model. As I've said, intermediate capital goods are activated at historical costs, and are later, when they are sold, they are incurred costs and decide whether there's profit or loss. And in addition, there are fixed costs, which are constituted by depreciation of fixed capital and financing costs. Now, moreover, the economy or this model strictly separates or distinguishes between physical capital and financial capital. Physical capital is modeled as a grid, and this grid, when you look at the horizontal layers of the grid, they represent stages of production in a, you could say, idea. And within each stage, there's a variety of goods, which is labeled, they're labeled alphabetically. And then you can, the firms, when they produce goods, they settle at a certain node, okay? This means a certain firm goes to the grid and says, okay, here I want to produce the good B1, and that it is there forever. But only if a firm goes to a certain node will this good actually be produced. Okay, that means in this model there's not always a, there are white spots, and sometimes there is no firm, okay, and this will be probably later. In addition, there's goods of type A are fixed capital goods, but that's only a convention. It's just a model. When a firm operates at a given node, it can use certain agents. It can use intermediate goods from the next higher stage, and there only from the same type or neighboring types. Okay, and it can also use machines, but then it has to use the machines from its own stage. When it then builds a product, produces a product, then it sells it and can sell it to the target markets, which are in this case then the markets B1, C1, or D1. Okay? These are just the rules of the game. It's completely conventional. You can choose different rules, but by introducing such rules, we introduce a capital structure which makes capital heterogeneous and having multiple specificity. But on the other hand, it is always used specifically, and the capital goods are hence complementary. So we have a capital structure, and this is important for Austrian economists, because when you look at neoclassical models, then capital is never structured. It's always one big thing, K. And this is why the neoclassicals have difficulties to show how business cycles would lead to distortions of the capital structure. Now in this model, we have the possibility to model that because we have heterogeneous capital and complementarity among capital goods. And when they then operate these firms, then they have a production function. Production function simply tells us how much goods can I produce with a given amount of inputs. And I'm not going to go into the details of this formula right now, but in essence, it's a fixed proportions production function, something like the Leontief production function, but it really only refers to physical capital, and it just tells us that when you combine labor with capital, you can produce something. And when you can buy, when you use fixed capital, you can enhance the productivity of labor. The more fixed capital goods, the more machines are available in the economy, the more intermediate goods can be processed, the more productive does the entire economy become. So if the capital stock of the economy grows, then the economy gets richer. And this is actually a function which is in line with the Misesian law of returns. It embodies this principle. I'll skip that. And one should note that in this system, as I have just described it, there's always a scarcity of capital. Because at the highest stage, there is never an intermediate good that will be available. Okay, so these firms which operate here at B5, they don't have any suppliers of intermediate goods, and hence they have to use labor alone. So this is a very unproductive way of working. But what could happen is obviously that some new firms come into existence, say at B6, and supplies intermediate goods to those firms. And then they will get more productive, and this increase in productivity will then propagate to the entire system and enhance output all over the place. So we get gains from use of capital and gains from the division of labor, both in the model. The model operates sequentially. We have time periods, and they have. This is like a rule how the model works. The firms first go to the market and they offer goods, and then the households offer their labor and so on, and then the firms invest, and the households allocate the budget, and so on. Then finally dividend payments are made. So this is just how the model evolves within a time period. Now, I've talked a lot about how the model is set up, but so far we've only talked about the playing ground of the agents. These are like the rules of the game. We have not said anything about what the agents do and why they do it and how they go about it. So now let's talk about behavioral aspects. The preferences of the households, they are modeled as sequences of intended actions. That is, each household has a sequence, and this sequence tells them, okay, the first act, first good that I want to buy is a good of type B. And then I want, after that, I want to buy another good of type B, and then I want to buy a good of type A, and so on and so on and so on. So this is just, these are the preferences of the households. They are not justified, but the good thing is that now one action happens after the other, and we can thus say that action actually drives the entire model. These goods are, these desired goods are complemented by a sequence of reservation prices. And these reservation prices, they simply describe the willingness to pay for a certain product. And they are determined according to the law of diminishing marginal utility. That is, each agent has a budget, and the more units of a certain good the agent has, the lower is his willingness to pay for another type of that good. This is a very Rothbardian thing. You can see that the man economy in state is basically the same process. You know, it's just formalized in the sense that we assume a functional relationship here which describes how much the willingness to pay changes in a from one purchase to another. Nonetheless, we are not saying anything about valuation here. Yeah, we do not know. Valuation remains subjective in this model. It always remains obscure. We cannot know how much somebody has valued a good. Yeah, but we know that he has actually valued it more than anything else because he has made the purchase. Yeah. So, whenever the marginal utility that is derived from a purchase exceeds the marginal utility of the money that the household has in the pocket who makes the purchase, and then it goes on. So this actually, it's largely a subjective value theory model. And as I said, the consumers then they simply go to the market and they choose certain offers, and they make purchases if the reservation price is according. Yeah. Okay. Now, something about money. Obviously, what then remains in every trade-off, in every consumption decision, the households value the consumer good in question against money. Yeah? And when they value the consumer good higher than the money that they have to give up, do they actually make the purchase? Now, when in a certain time period all reservation prices have become binding, then they are not willing to spend anything on anything. And the rest is cash holdings. Yeah? So this is somehow the valuation of money. And then they also form an estimate of the purchasing power of money simply by dividing the number of purchases that they've made in a time period by the budget that they had at the beginning of the time period. And this way they get an idea of how much a monetary unit can buy. So this is an emulation of the regression theorem, obviously. They use this estimate of the purchasing power of money when they decide whether they are willing to supply their labor on the labor market, because this decision is governed by the trade-off between leisure time and real consumption, if not working. Yeah. And in order to assess this trade-off, they need to have an estimate, a forward-looking estimate of the purchasing power of money. And they get this estimate from the number of purchases that they've just made in the last period. And take it to the market and they see the budget, they know what their budget is, they know what their purchasing power is, and then they know, okay, this is what I can expect to consume if I'm not working. And then they know how much they value this real consumption against the leisure time that would be available if they're not choosing to work. Now, this trade-off then determines a reservation wage. And this is simply like a reservation price, simply on the labor market, and will be binding or not whenever. It depends on how, what offer then they get from the firms. So far for the households. Then turn to the firms. The firms actually have four different types of actions. They have a price setting rationale, a wage setting rationale. They have to decide about what to invest and how much to invest and how to finance these investments. What they do not decide, these firms, is actually how much they sell, because it's exogenous to them, it depends on their customers. And how much they produce, because this actually depends directly on their investment decision. Moreover, the dividend goals are given to them by their owners, and also the prices of the factors are exogenous because they are set by other firms. Now, and the goal of their pricing decision is to maximize revenue, not profit. Yeah? Because investment always precedes sales. Yeah? You have to invest something before you can sell something. And therefore, the only motive which governs your pricing decision is actually a revenue maximizing rationale and not a profit maximization, because the costs are already there, they are sunk costs, so to say. And so what the only thing they are concerned is then revenue. However, they don't know what the revenue maximizing price would actually be, because they do not know the willingness to pay of their customers, they do not know what their competitors will do in the market, they have maybe a new pricing strategy. Yeah? So forward-looking, you have no idea what price is actually optimal. What they do is then they use a system of a process of try and error to find out, yeah, what would be an optimal price. And this price, this rationale works as follows. They have produced something, they have these goods in their balance sheets, and then they have a target range for their inventories, which are left over at the end of the time period. That is, when I sell all my goods in a given time period, then it was probably I've been too cheap. Yeah, then I have certainly not gotten the marginal seller. However, when I do not sell anything, or when my inventories keep piling up, then it was probably too expensive. Yeah? Because nobody's willing to buy that good at that price. And so these are the hints that the firms get from their own sales performance. When they sell everything, then they raise the price or the quantity target. Yeah? When the inventories are too high, say they go outside of this target range, yeah, then they lower the price or that target quantity. Yeah? And this way they try to influence the revenue that they make in the market. And
is there a mistake on the second one? Because you say the inventories are too high, the firm either raises the price or be lower than the price.
The inventories are too high. But that's absolutely correct. I'm sorry. Yeah. that is wrong, and it's obviously the other way around. You're totally correct. Yeah. But nonetheless, I mean, this is the principle how they go about. Yeah? When they've sold everything, then they will go up in price and quantity, and vice versa. Yeah. Similar rationale applies to the labor market. They make offers on the labor market. They have no idea what the reservation wages of their workers are, but they know what has happened in the past. And if in the past they placed in a successful wage offer, so the offer the worker accepted the offer, then in the next period they will go down a little bit, and they try to reap profits this way. Yeah. On the other hand, if the worker says no, this is below my reservation wage, then they will go up again. So again, it's a process of try and error. No, complete uncertainty. They do not know what's going to happen, but they try and position themselves optimally in this economic system. And then they also have to decide about their investments. And for that, they do the following. They compare the unit costs of an investment with the price that they are charging in the market. And obviously, whenever the price is higher than the unit cost, then they can expect to make a profit. So they would actually make the investment. How do they calculate unit costs? Well, they simply look at what an investment would cost them on average per time period and divide this by the number of goods that they can produce with this investment. And this is the unit cost. I mean, this is really straightforward. Yeah. And they then compare this with the actually sales price, with the actual sales price, and whenever the unit costs are low enough, then they make the purchase. In addition, they always look that they do not overinvest. Yeah, when their output exceeds their target output, then they stop investing also. Yeah. This is what they do. They go to the market. They go to the labor market. They select an offer there, they go to the market for capital goods, select an offer there, to the market for machines. And whichever has the lowest unit cost is the preferred investment, and then they compare with the price. And if it's rational for them, apparently rational, given the knowledge that they have, then they make the investment. And then this is what happens. Obviously, there can be more than one firm in a market, and this introduces competition. Competition can mean, well, if there's only one firm, then it actually monopolizes the market, and most likely it will produce at a high or sell at a higher price than necessary. And will also offer lower quality, because at that higher price, some customers are not willing to buy all these goods. But it could be that this is revenue maximizing for the firm, and so it may be the case that a lot of this ends up in a situation like the one shown on the left panel. However, when a second firm enters the market, then it can secure a larger market share by offering a lower price. And they will actually bid each other down all the time. And they do so until the unit costs become binding. And in this competitive state, there will always be different marginal firms which are at the price which is revenue maximizing or not. In the next time period, all firms will probably update their strategy and come up with a new price and a new quantity. And we will have different market leaders all the time. Yeah. By the way, it can also be the case that there's a cartel in the market, but it's an unlikely case. Let me quickly say something about banks before I'm running out of time. The banks also have a strategy which maximizes profit, and they maximize revenue on their sales and profits on their purchases. kind of similar as the firms. However, it's a bit different because the banks cannot act on a marginal basis as the firms do, because they cannot really control the quantity as precisely as the firms, because the banks go to the market and offer a certain interest rate, and when a customer goes and says, okay, at this rate I'm willing to save, and then they accept the offer and incur certain costs. The point is they have a rationale which separates their own funds from their non-mobile funds. Own funds is OF, and they use the own funds to make interest and dividend payments, and they use their non-mobile funds to make savings and redemption payments, or to make loans. And they maintain this separation of funds in order to assess the situation of the market, and also to make sure that they are not paying out money which is actually not theirs. Okay. I think I'll be a bit quick on banks and get to the functioning of the model. Let me just say that the banks also have a quantity target, and this quantity target is always determined by their lending capacity, LC. Yeah? And given their lending capacity, which is determined by the amount of savings they have taken on, they can then grant loans, and they will do so based on a strategy that's actually also revenue maximizing. And the revenue maximizing strategy is, again, a strategy which like withholds quantity from the market as much as possible. They try to equally distribute their new loans over the amount of time that they have the money available. So again, they are trying to withhold a certain quantity from the market, and this is a really maximizing strategy. Yeah. I'm happy to discuss this later, but let me come to the workings of the model. First off, this is probably the slide that got me into this conference, it's about bankruptcy. Whenever a firm cannot pay its debt obligations, then it has to fight liquidity. And then a certain process starts which manages this situation. First of all, the firm gets another time period and see whether the next time period it can actually pay back its loans. But if this is not the case, then the firm has to file bankruptcy. And then all the remaining assets are sold, and the cash that is there is distributed among the creditors, and then the rest of the physical capital is lost, and the firm files bankruptcy. It vanishes from the market. And it's gone. But time again, new firms are being created, and these firms are created because the banks, or let's say an investment bank, sells equity shares to the households. Equity shares are, by the way, a consumption good or a good, just as any other good, and it appears in the preference ranking or in the sequence of intended actions of the households. Now, when the households buy equity shares from a new created firm, or from a firm that is about to be created, then this money is the venture capital of that firm, and it goes to the market and it settles on a grid, on the grid somewhere. And this way, the entire system gains flexibility. Because if bankruptcy occurs at one area of the grid, then there will be continuously new firms being created elsewhere, and they may be profitable. And this is how the system works. First of all, the system is ruled by a distribution of preferences, and these preferences they constitute something like a money impulse which enters the economic system. And at all times, a given money impulse can always sustain a certain production structure. And this, within a certain very narrow margin, always the same, yeah? Because the more credit there is available, the more money is available at the higher stage of production. And hence, the longer the structure of production can become. And we can see that, whenever this preference distribution changes, then what happens is that, say, okay, the consumption preferences, they change from green to orange, then what will happen is that we'll see bankruptcies in certain areas of the system, but then new firms will be there and they will try something in the orange parts, and they will see, oh, it's profitable, I'm still there and I can continue producing. And so over time the entire system adapts to the preferences of the households. So we have complete consumer sovereignty in this model. And the capital structure, which is exhibited by the model, is determined by the consumer preferences. What happens if savings go up? As I already said, then we would have, it changes from green to orange. And we would see that there's less consumption spending, but more credit available and more equity investments available. And that means that there's more money going to the firms which are at the higher stage of production. And they use this money to buy labor, to buy capital goods. They can actually now compete with the firms at the lower stages, and they can bid away those factors of production, so the factors of production will move down. But this means that, as I've already said, that we have now more capital goods in the economy, that we have more division of labor and so on, and now these gains, these productivity gains, will propagate through the entire system, and they will lower the unit costs at the subsequent stages. And then competition will do the rest and drive down the prices. And at those lower prices, the households are actually willing to buy more of these goods. And this means that with saving, the economy gets richer. Now, obviously, we can also simulate, we can have something like credit expansion. And this would then, in first instance, have the same effect as an increase in savings. But but obviously, this does not hold forever, because if either the monetary expansion ceases or the purchasing power of the money in the pocket of the household catches up, then this structure of production can no longer be sustained, and we have the business cycle, basically. You see that bankruptcy then happens all over the board, and a lot of physical capital is lost, and the total production of the economy falls rapidly. So this is how the business cycle comes into being. And we can show this, it's like an endogenous business cycle in the entire model, and it's triggered by monetary policy. Now, all this can be monitored, as I've said, in an economic observatory, and we can see the patterns which emerge over the business cycle, or simply in general, whenever we have changes in the economy. And we can see how such a business cycle will show up in the system of national accounts. We can see that the simulation works in real time, so we can actually have that on the screen, and we can follow and analyze what kind of patterns we would see over the business cycle. Yeah, so this is actually, I think, also maybe a tool of analysis which would help us understand GDP figures a little better. And I think I have to come to an end. We will simply end with a comparison of models. And I compare this model with a DSGE model, and then I have to say that I think we are much more realistic in many, many aspects. Yeah, first of all, this model is driven by action and not by mechanics. We have price dispersion instead of the law of one price. We have uncertainty instead of rational expectation. We have actually money. Money is there in the economy, and as we know, most DSG models do not have money. Capital is heterogeneous, and we have actually do have profit. Yeah. So this is, we are much more realistic in many, many regards. And I think it's also actually still easier than a DSG model. Moreover, what I should say is what I think is generally overlooked is that DSG models, they assume a very normative character when relying on optimization. You know, because what these models actually answer is the question, what should an economy optimally do instead of what happens if? And this is why these models have extreme difficulties to show what happens if there's a suboptimal development. Now, in our case, we simply positively analyze what's happening if something happens. So we have causality instead of synchronicity, and therefore we could model endogenous cycles instead of what neoclassicals call real cycles. I think I stop here and take questions. Thank you.